the deadliest of the seven deadly sins. That's the reputation pride has in the history of religion. There's truth in that reputation, but only when the word means an excessive preoccupation with oneself, an ego so inflamed that the whole world revolves around the perpendicular pronoun I. But the word has other meanings, like self-respect. And far from being deadly, self-respect is absolutely essential to a productive, happy life. So as with almost every other character trait, we walk on a razor's edge between too much pride, which destroys community, and too little, which destroys the person. We have not always remembered in preaching to compliment the right kind of pride. We glorify humility as if it meant a total lack of self-confidence, so that some people spend their whole lives looking down at their shoelaces and thinking they ought to say over and over, like a litany, "I don't deserve any credit. It was all luck. I'm dreadfully sorry that I didn't manage to do more." And this attitude leads either to a personality sickness, which paralyzes potential, or else it turns into hypocrisy, in which we pretend to have escaped the monster pride, but in truth are eaten alive by it. No one, I would guess, has more pride than the person who thinks he has none. There is a story someplace about Plato's entertaining some of his friends one day in a room that had a richly ornamented, very expensive couch. Diogenes came in, dirty as usual, because he scoffed at the luxury of bathing, and critical as usual about the material comforts of life. And when he saw the couch, he got up on it with his feet and stomped around and said, "Thus do I trample upon the pride of Plato." To which his host replied quietly, "Yes, but with greater pride." I remember one preacher in my childhood church who was so proud of his humility that he could never stop talking about it. I learned early that a public profession of humility is as likely as not to cover a massive, swollen pride. But some pride we have to have. Christine Park read a few minutes ago from one of my favorite places in the New Testament, where Paul asks us to offer ourselves as living sacrifices to God. Now, when you remember that in his Hebrew scripture, only the most perfect things could be offered to God, you realize that he's paying us a high compliment. The best you have to offer is yourself. Present your life to God in the conviction that he will find it acceptable. It's true that he says a moment later that we should also not think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. But right now I'm interested in the first half of his argument, that we must have enough pride in ourselves to believe that we are worthy gifts God can cherish. So one of the important things we do for each other is to instill in each other the right amount of self-esteem. I don't know many things parents can do that will help their children more. Teachers can build or destroy pride. They help to make, sometimes to ruin, a life. We read much right now about competency tests for teachers. Can they get their verb forms right? Handle basic math? Unfortunately, we have no competency tests for wisdom, sensitivity. Does it matter? Here's a true story. First day in class, teacher reading the roll in homeroom. She comes to a girl's name, Vinnie McAllister. Vinnie is so far away from here, the name doesn't matter. The teacher pauses, looks up. Is Ron McAllister your father? Yes, ma'am. And is Jack McAllister your brother? Faltering a bit this time. Yes, ma'am. You need to know that these two had both been in jail briefly for selling marijuana. The teacher said, while the class listened, so Ron and Jack are your father and brother. Well, I sure hope you're not like them. You're thinking, come on now, no teacher could be that cruel. But one was, and others are, in less obvious ways. And what those few can do to children sometimes is criminal. I think you could make a case for arresting that woman I just described. She's far more dangerous than a petty thief who picks up a wrench in the auto parts store. She has stolen pride, the essential ingredient for a good life, the stiffening agent that keeps your head up when bad fortune makes it want to wilt. So what should she have done, this person into whose care a child had been committed? Invite the child in for a couple of minutes one day to say, because everybody knew, I'm sorry about your father and brother. Those things happen sometimes to otherwise good people who make a mistake. I have faith in you that you'll do a good job and make them proud of you. Come see me if you have any problems with the other kids. Because the most desperate need for Vinnie was that she be able to love herself. Do you remember the words, you are to love your neighbor as you love yourself? Well, I say this with deep conviction from reading and from experience. If you don't love yourself, you will make a casualty out of the neighbor you are supposed to love. And you may not love yourself unless somebody makes you believe that you are lovable. Here's another memory of the difference pride can make. 1 month ago, Billy and I drove to the Ozarks to meet some dear old friends, look at the autumn color, and hike around in the hill country. On the way, we passed within a few miles of a place where I preached when I was only 16. I shouldn't have been allowed to preach at 16, but I was. So I drove to Jerusalem, Arkansas, and then on to a kind of non-place called Granny's Hollow. All of it a long, long time ago. Somebody had to do what they called keeping the preacher. And I will confess that I always hoped on those occasions it would be a nice, clean place. But sometimes, well, this time, they sent me to the most run-down house in the county. I had an old car that I drove as far as I could. And then I had to park it and ford a little stream and walk up the hill to the shack. Doors did not exist, or else they were sprung open. Chickens wandered in and out of rooms. I speak truth. And when I awoke after my first night to an odd scratching sound, I saw a mule's head stuck through the open, unscreened window and two huge brown eyes gazing at me curiously. Flies were so thick that at mealtime it was a race to bring a forkful of food to your mouth before they could settle on it. I broke open a biscuit at the first breakfast, and the center ran down my hand. I kept turning down offers of food until it became a problem to know what to eat. I finally spent a lot of time in the orchard pulling green apples and finding once the treasure of a small ripe watermelon. The woman who kept that house was not fortunate in her looks. She always had a snuff streak on her chin. She wore an old flour sack dress. She seemed to have given up on life, and no wonder. And then one day, some people walked across the creek and up the hill to the house, and I saw the woman's face begin to change as they got closer. A little girl, about 4 or 5, ran ahead of the rest and jumped into the woman's arms and kissed her and said, "I love you, Grandma." There was a look on the woman's face that day that I had not seen before. She cooked a decent meal and shooed the flies away and smiled a couple of times. If one person loves you, you get the feeling that you are absolutely indispensable. The little girl had no idea she was creating pride, but we know what her gift was, and we know how many ways there are of doing that for other people if we wish to take the time. Across the street from us, in the first church of our marriage, there lived a short, stout woman by the name of Annie Legan. So short, she had to pull a stool up to the mailbox to forage around for the mail. I asked her one day, "Why don't you just lower the mailbox?" "Oh," she said, "I can reach all those tall things." She meant the magazines and newspapers. "What I'm looking for are those little ones." You know what she meant? Those little cards that said, "Happy birthday, we're thinking of you." Or, "I came by Friday to say hello, but you were gone. We miss you." Those didn't come often enough to justify lowering the mailbox, but they were what she wanted, so she could feel important to someone and have a reason for getting through the day. You'll be thinking of Christmas gifts for the next 3 weeks. May I remind you that you have it in your power always to lift someone's sense of self-esteem who has started to doubt, to give the gift of restored pride, which is priceless. Not only priceless because it makes it possible for someone else to live, but because it saves all the rest of us from the miseries and complaints of the one who has no pride. You know the people whose first word to you after hello is always the same, a catalog of their troubles. They can see that this bores you after a while, but they haven't enough pride to keep from doing it. The reason you don't run crying to people all the time about your sorrows is because you are too proud to inflict them on your friends. What a blessing that is for everybody. That brilliant English novelist, George Eliot, said something about it I'd like you to hear. We mortals, men and women, devour many a disappointment between breakfast and dinner time, keep back the tears, and look a little pale about the lips, and in answer to inquiries, say, "Oh, nothing." Pride helps us, and pride is not a bad thing when it only urges us to hide our own hurts. How we admire people who do not speak easily of their troubles. How glad we are for the pride that wants to save us by saying, "It's nothing." We shall have to insist sometimes and get behind that pride to the truth so we can help. But how nice it is to help the person who is not forever calling for it. Some people here have that kind of pride because of childhood experiences. Some people in this city don't have it at all. And my main point this morning is that we do a good and useful thing when we help someone find it. It is conventional to speak of God as the one who made us. It is also true that we create each other. Watch it happen in this story of one evening in a small town in Kansas, a couple of hours from here. Several years ago, a young woman with no family had come to work in an old hotel. The only job she could get, the pay was not much, her meals and a room in the attic. She had almost no self-respect left, so it was easy for others to show her no respect. The manager yelled at her constantly, "You didn't get the floor clean. Come down here and scrub it again. Make the beds up better. Stack the dishes in the right place." She dressed about the same every day. Why worry much about what you wear when you're only going to be yelled at? She had a remnant of pride for a while about her hair and her dress, but about the only thing that happened to her was that boys drove by occasionally in pickup trucks and yelled crude things, so that after a while she didn't even bother to look up. One early afternoon, after months of this, a man stopped by she'd never seen, with a touch of courtesy about him that was as alien to her life as if he had come from another planet. He said, "Pardon me, ma'am, I hate to disturb you when you're working, but I need some advice, please." She couldn't believe it for a minute. Then she stood up just a little bit taller and touched her hair to straighten it. He said, "I'm a stranger in town. I'm looking for 412 Western Avenue, a man named Barton. Do you happen to know him?" She tried to remember. He saw she was flustered. He thought to take her mind off her confusion. He looked around. He said, "You do a nice job here, miss. I can almost see myself in this floor. 412 Western, could you tell me how to get there?" She points, manages to tell him it's 5 blocks down the street and 3 more to the right. He thanks her and says, "I'm sorry to have bothered you. Please tell the manager I'll probably be back to eat here this evening and spend the night. Thank you very much for your help." He leaves. That evening, before dinner, she goes up to her attic room. She looks at herself in the mirror. She walks over to the closet and takes out the yellow dress. "I think I'll wear this tonight."